Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday right here on Mind Talk. Thoughtful Thursday is the day that you and I focus on new learning and expanded learning with conversations and guests who challenge us to think more broadly, more wisely, more thoughtfully. I am pleased to welcome to the program Mr. Andrew Foss, who is the author of The Bully's Trap, Bullying in the Workplace. Andrew Foss, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you so much.
Now, Andrew, in taking a look at your book, I noticed that it begins with a quote. And I am now quoting, "The workplace is the most dangerous place to be in America." And as I began to do some more looking into that, I came up with a statistic that is actually about 20 years old, which says that, again, according to the U.S. Department of Justice, the workplace is the most dangerous place to be in America. And that's who you quoted. The problem is so pervasive that the Center for Disease Control has classified workplace violence as a national epidemic, with workplace homicide as being one of the fastest growing categories of murder in the United States. Now, as I said, this information is about 20 years old, but I'm afraid that it's still accurate.
Well, it is still accurate, and I would suggest to you that it's gotten a lot worse over the last decade, and primarily as a result of the financial meltdown that we experienced and are still feeling the impacts from.
So, in fact, going to work, you might be taking your life into your own hands. Is there any way to tell?
Well, there's one statistic I use all the time, and it is a study done by Stanford University and in conjunction with a Harvard professor, and they attribute 120,000 deaths annually due to workplace stress. So it, when you look at that, it ranks right up there in terms of casualties. And so many people think of workplace violence as physical. The bulk of workplace violence is actually psychological.
All right. Given that, you and I have just been talking very briefly about stress and violence and death in the workplace. And what brings you to the Mind Talk audience today is the book that you've written entitled The Bully's Trap, Bullying in the Workplace. Would you consider bullying a stress inducer, a form of violence in the workplace?
Absolutely. And it is one of the number one stress inducers in the environment. My book is about bullying, but the bigger message is answering the question, why bullies bully? And the reason bullies bully is because of organizational cultures and leadership that not only condone bullying, but in many instances even encourage it as a method to get more productivity, or I've seen in many, many cases, as a method to force people out of an organization.
All right, so this sounds pretty scary. And so for the person who's listening in, they're saying, okay, here's this guy. I don't know who he is, but he's talking about organizations and bullies. What does he know about the workplace? Andrew, what do you know about being in the workplace?
Well, I offer a pretty unique perspective. I've been in the corporate environment for the bulk of my career, which is over 40 years, in executive positions. I offer a very unique perspective because early in my career, I was called out for being a bully, and that was a incredible lesson to learn at age 26, I was the youngest vice president for Loblaw Companies Limited, which is the largest food chain in food retailer in Canada. And a pretty tough environment. And I thought in order to get ahead, that I had to behave the way I saw others behaving. And that was, they didn't really label it bullying back then, but you were supposed to be a tough manager. And that lesson taught me that respect is a far more powerful motivator than fear. And it's something that I have adapted. I did adapt in my career in terms of creating what I now refer to as a psychologically safe work environment.
Well, let me ask you this. At 26, you were in an executive position. What kinds of things were you doing that, as you look back on them now, you realize were actually bullying behavior?
Well, being short-fused, micromanaging to the point of badgering, being overly critical, being overly harsh, being overly demanding, not listening, and threatening people. So, that was a playbook that I saw continually being played out by successful managers in the environment. And the executive vice president, who was kind of the godfather at Loblaw at the time, came into my office one day, and he started stoking up a pipe. They allowed smoking back then. And he indicated to me, or asked me, for some advice. And I said, sure. And he said, well, my problem is I have a young manager, and he's doing what I just described to you, and I'm perplexed as to what to do. So I'm thinking, well, I better give him a pretty good answer here. So I said, well, Bob, I'd fire the SOB. And he takes a drag from his pipe, and he says, well, son, you're the SOB I'm talking about. So thankfully, he did not follow my advice, and I went on to enjoy a very successful career, largely due to the change in my approach to managing and leading.
So early on, you were fortunate enough to work with somebody who was able to talk to you, not fire you, but talk to you and give you some guidance. But again, I would think it would have been really difficult because, as you said, you were sort of following along in the footsteps of the other successful managers in your place of employment. So to think that you're doing everything you need to do in order to get ahead and then to discover not so much, I would think that would have been quite a shift in your own just sort of emotional equilibrium.
Well, it was, and it was not a light switch that you turn off and on. And his advice to me was really get to understand who you're working with and understand how they feel, and more importantly, understand why they feel the way they do. And that will give you the answers. And that is not to say that, you know, you're expected to be a soft manager. You can be a very tough manager by setting high expectations, as long as they're reasonable, by ensuring your people have what they need from you to be able to deliver on the expectations you have, and giving them the critical feedback, positive and negative, on an ongoing basis in a discussion-type format, therein lies your answers. And that's something that I followed, again, right throughout my career. And it's something that I have insisted that anyone in a management position that reported to me directly or indirectly follow the same methodology in terms of managing and leading.
How much pushback do you find yourself getting when this is the stance you take with your folks?
Well, it's interesting. People that report and have reported to me respond to it incredibly well. I've had very, very few instances where people were uncomfortable in terms of having those kind of discussions. And what I'm finding in many, many organizations, one of the biggest frustrations rests in performance management. And it's usually a one-of experience every year, very bureaucratic in nature, and both managers and subordinates are uncomfortable with the process. And so the approach I've taken has been exceptionally well received, and it's something that I encourage organizations that I consult with to follow. I call it the covenant, and it's really based on the ethic of reciprocity, but the whole premise is for people to be comfortable in expressing their feelings and having a discussion relative to how they perform and behave.
And is this the 360 review, or is the one that people have discomfort with the 360 review?
Yeah, it is not the 360 review. It's not engagement surveys. It's not the annual performance review mechanism, and because those are processes that most people are uncomfortable with, and I have yet to find an organization successfully applying those methodologies.
Interesting. For those who are listening who don't know what a 360 review is, can you just give a sentence or two as to what it is?
Sure. It's really a peer employee and boss feedback mechanism. And so it's self-evaluation and then evaluation in terms of how others see you, how your coworkers see you, and how your employer sees you.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that's actually one of the least useful, most stressful kinds of reviews that people can experience in the workplace?
Well, it works if there is a high level of trust, and unfortunately, in today's environment, it's a rare organization that has that level of trust where people will be comfortable in giving that kind of feedback that they're expected to give.
Mm. You say that in order for workplace bullying to stop, that it requires a cultural transformation. So that sounds huge and difficult and a big deal.
And it is. The example I'll give of an organization and a leader trying to create that cultural transformation is Catholic Church. And the pushback that that he is receiving from the hierarchy in the church, who are fearful that it's going to dissolve or dilute their power and control, and that's really what it's all about.
And when you say he, who are you referring to?
Pope Francis. Sorry.
Okay.
And there are some great indicators out there, but there are, in terms of his intentions, but he is proving how very difficult it is in most organizations. My view, however, is that it is a relatively simple thing to do.
Interesting.
And it does require being directional in nature relative to that. And an example of an organization that's doing that is General Motors with Mary Barra, who inherited the ignition switch scandal. And a few months ago, she brought in all of her senior people and indicated that obviously we have to fix the engine switch or ignition switch issue. But that is not the issue here. The issue is our culture. And the question that we need to answer is, why did people in the know not feel comfortable enough in blowing the whistle, in exposing this issue? Why did we have to find out the way we found out? And we need to change our culture so that people are comfortable enough in expressing themselves, and in particular when they see something that could jeopardize the organization.
And you know, when I hear you use the term whistleblower, you know that there are people listening and just hearing that term, and they begin to tighten and get a little anxious, and they're not quite sure where you're going next with that. We're going to take a break, but when we return, we will continue with more of this conversation with Andrew Foss, who is the author of The Bully's Trap, Bullying in the Workplace. Don't go away, folks. Andrew, we've been talking about the impact of stress, so emotional stress, on the psychological well-being of folks in the workplace. And moments ago, you used a word that sort of sends fear into the hearts of many, whether they see themselves as a whistleblower or are afraid that there is a whistleblower among their midst. How often would you say whistleblowers experience bullying in the workplace?
I'm just throwing out a number here, but the majority of times, unfortunately. And the unfortunate thing is that there are not enough people in the know who do come forward when they see wrongdoing, whether it's abuse or whether it's unethical or illegal behavior. And I have asserted that if people in the know came forward earlier, the financial and mortgage meltdown could have been avoided. And the problem is that not enough people who were in the know came forward. And whistleblower is seen to be a derogatory term, where it should be considered a virtue in an organization. Many organizations are sitting on ticking time bombs, and Volkswagen is one of the best examples of a culture, autocratic culture, where people were afraid to come forward, and their emissions scandal is sufficient enough to bring an organization down. And many organizations have things going on in their organization that that the board and CEO should be made aware of, and in too many instances they are made aware of it in the news.
One of the early stories that you tell in The Bully's Trap is the experience of Vera, and I'm going to ask you to share that story with our listeners. In so many ways, it seemed as though that story was a classic, classic example of what bullying actually looks like in the workplace. So share that, if you would.
Sure, and Vera's story is really the reason why I called the book The Bully's Trap. And Vera fell into a bully's trap, where Vera is a victim who became, in the eyes of the boss, human resources, and the employer, as the villain. So Vera was passed over for a promotion, and Vera was more qualified than the male who became her boss. Her boss felt that Vera was a threat, and started almost from the outset to discredit Vera in the eyes of human resources and the senior management, and using tactics like setting unreasonable expectations, criticizing her at every point, discrediting her publicly, not giving her the information she needed to do her job, having her not attend meetings that she should be attending, blaming her for what went wrong, and taking credit for what went right. And Vera was a 20-year employee, 20-plus year employee, solid work performance, good reviews, and this started to affect her both attitude and performance. And once that started, the supervisor started pressing his boss and human resources to discipline her and ultimately fire her.
So her boss created the conditions under which she could not thrive, and then said that she was failing to thrive and needed to be gone.
Yes.
Okay.
He sabotaged her.
Okay.
Simple as that. So she rather than being a victim, became the villain.
What role, if any, do you think the gender differences played in this scenario? She was a woman, her boss was a man, and I think that the HR folks were male as well. I don't recall.
On that one, it was a female HR representative.
Okay.
But I don't think they did play the gender card. They may have in terms of promoting the male, but in terms of the abuse, I wouldn't attach a gender title on that.
Okay.
Gender does play a very significant role in the whole area of abuse and bullying. Obviously, sexual abuse is higher than sexual abuse against males, although that is significant as well. But I wouldn't label that particular story a gender issue.
Okay. I think one of the things that's important to interject is that, you know, there are many folks who see bullying as outright threats or demands for sexual or sexually inappropriate behavior. But that's not at all what happened to Vera, and it was clearly a case of bullying.
Clearly a case of bullying. And some of it was very subtle. But some of it was very direct. The issue that I find in many, many cases is when you let me just back up a bit. If you most people, when you talk about bullying, they relate to bullying in schools because of the media school bullying has covered that in a very, very good way. Unfortunately, it's because of the number of suicides of people who, children who have been bullied. Although there are similarities to bullying in schools, bullying in the workplace is far more subtle, and it's more basically more subtle and psychological. And in schools, it turns out being more physical and cyber. But cyberbullying is becoming a bigger and bigger issue in the workplace as well.
And, of course, cyberbullying is using social media to harass and threaten and frighten
folks.
Yeah,
and as well as using emails to constantly badger. So workers cannot get away from the situation very readily if the manager just keeps this badgering on a 24/7 basis.
You say that Vera fell into the bully's trap. When a bully sets out to entrap you, how do you avoid it?
Well, there's in my book I have a number of points on that, and the first step is to talk to somebody about it and get a perspective as to what's going on. So the first step is listening to your gut and instinct, because when you see or feel something is amiss, then tie seemingly unrelated comments, events, and situations together, and it usually adds up to something. So as soon as your gut tells you that there's something amiss, start becoming more aware and write it down in terms of what you're going through. The advice I give to most people who are being bullied is do not deal with it alone. And so many people, and this is what creates the stress and ultimately in some situations addictions, and in some cases mental health. The people who are severely bullied, the majority of people who are severely bullied suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I found in so many cases people were unaware of what was going on, and they didn't connect everything together. Whereas if they were able to identify what they were going through as bullying, they could have taken steps and can take steps to stop it.
Let me back up a little bit.
If I could, I will tell you one story.
Great.
That had a horrific outcome, and what I'm finding is that it's not unique. I gave a talk on the topic, and I pretty much relayed Vera's story. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, could I call you sometime and talk about what my wife's going through? Because as you were talking, the penny dropped. And I tend to think what my wife is going through is exactly what you described. So he took out my number and called me 10 days later in tears, indicating that he called me 2 days too late because his wife committed suicide 2 days ago.
Oh, my.
And I spent a fair amount of time with him after that and going over what she had been going through. And she did keep a record of instances, but it was clearly a classic case like Vera's, where she was just being badgered and sabotaged to the point they were trying to force her out, and they did force her out.
In Vera's case, what happened?
In Vera's case, she quit and has had difficulty in finding alternate employment since.
And why is that?
Because she got blacklisted.
All right, so that brings up, of course, another issue. You're in a workplace, you're being bullied, you can't, it's almost like you can't go and you can't stay. You don't want to stay because it's ultimately having an impact not only on you physically, but emotionally, and consequently the people around you who care about you. So you don't want to stay and put anyone, particularly yourself, in that space. On the other hand, if you leave, you can be without income. They can do all kinds of things to your reputation, and like Vera, you can find yourself blacklisted and unable to get a job. So what do you do?
Well, the first thing you do is ask that it be stopped. So maybe I'll just back up a bit. What you should not do is fall into the trap, i.e., you should not have it affect your attitude and performance. And that's a pretty tough thing for me to say, easy thing to say, but it's very, very difficult to do, but it can be done, given the right attitude. So recognize that, number one, this is not, you're not the only person that this has happened to. There is a way out, but the way out is not to have it affect you to the point your performance suffers or your attitude changes, giving the bully the ammunition. The method that I would recommend in most cases, unless there is zero trust at all, is to confront it by indicating you do not appreciate being abused in this manner, and if it continues, then I'm going to have to take it to another level.
Would you actually use the word abused?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, you know, the linguistics, you know, there's so much human resource gobbledygook out there talking about, how one should talk about things like this. And my experience is call it for what it is. And if you believe you're being abused, then use that word.
What if the person who is abusing you is at the top? There's no other place to go.
The same rules apply. And even the person at the top reports to somebody, a board of directors, or if it's a family company, an owner. But there's always a somebody that, or in most cases, there's somebody that is at a higher level.
Okay.
Now, the other is it shouldn't be an overly complicated situation.
What do you mean?
Let's take sexual harassment. The issue in most cases with sexual harassment is that it is not confronted, and people are afraid to call somebody out on it. And because they're not called out on it, it goes further and further and further to the point there is actual abuse. So I've handled, I cannot tell you how many situations where there was things went from flirtation to harassment to abuse.
And when you say abuse, are you talking about rape or forced
touching? Okay. Rape, unwanted.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And I found that the most effective way for a manager to deal with it is, as soon as there is a whiff of any of this going on, and there usually is, there's usually, you know, around the water cooler chats that something is going on, I go to the person who it's alleged that is doing it, and indicate to that person, I'm hearing a lot of noise, and I don't like what I'm hearing, and if you're doing anything to make this noise or creating this noise, stop.
So you're very direct.
Very direct. And if the person reacts to that by saying, you know, you're accusing me of something, my reaction is, no, I'm not. All I'm doing is telling you I'm hearing noise.
And you want the noise to stop.
And don't deny me what I'm hearing.
Okay.
And in 90% of the cases that I dealt with like that, the noise has gone away and the situation has gone away. And that is what most people who are targeted want. They don't want a Bill Cosby-type scenario where they have to relive what they're going through.
They want it to end. Yeah. Make the point in your book that there are many organizations who actually have resources in place that people could go to for assistance if they're feeling that they are the victims of bullying or any other kind of objectionable situation in the workplace, but often may choose not to because they don't trust management.
That's right. And, you know, it's ironic because the employee assistance program are usually managed by a third party. And the support that they provide to employees is confidential. But if you operate in a toxic environment or an environment where there is very little trust, EAP programs support programs are not utilized to the extent that they could be.
And the other value I would suggest to EAP programs, from what I'm aware of, is that they tend to be at no cost to the employee. So not only do you not have to take anything out of your pocket to pay for it, but as you said, the confidentiality is guaranteed by virtue of the license of the person you're working with. And very often, these EAP programs are off-site, which certainly adds to the sense of comfort and security, I would think.
Yes, and again, it's unfortunate that that they're not utilized to the extent that they are.
Your research also says that there is a disproportionate focus on short-term results at the expense of sustainable long-term performance. Is that one of the views that, for lack of a better way to phrase this, sort of helps the abuser to feel justified in his or her bullying behavior? Because
yes.
You got to get the results, you got to get the results.
Yeah, and it's all about the numbers, and unfortunately, it also creates an environment where shortcuts can be taken, and in many instances, those shortcuts are unethical or illegal. And one of the biggest stress factors that people have, according to my research, and we're still validating it I'm working with Yale on a major study on the topic of stress in the workplace. One of the biggest stressors is people either having to be involved or be witness to wrongdoing. That is something an organization, has to seriously look at. And as a CEO or a board member, it's one of those things that would keep me awake at night, saying, "Okay, the market is calling for us to perform at a certain level in this very short period of time." How can you reconcile that against the way we conduct business? And are we forcing people to do things that we would be ashamed of?
Andrew, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue right here. Andrew, you mentioned board of directors, and as we know, both nonprofit and profit-making organizations have boards of directors. What if the bullies are the board?
Well, that creates a kind of a domino effect, and we're seeing more and more of that in terms of activist shareholders placing pressure on the on other board members and the CEO for the financial results, with relatively little regard for other stakeholders. And so what usually plays out is the activist shareholder bullies the other board members, the entire board bullies the CEO bullies the executive team, the executive team bullies the managers, and the managers bully the employees. And all of these bullies usually take it home and bully their families.
Okay, so now I'm ready to apply for unemployment insurance for the rest of my lifetime.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm ready to apply for unemployment insurance for the rest of my lifetime. I'm never leaving my home. I don't want to be on a board. I don't want to know a board. And I'm not going to work.
Now, I'm explaining in that is the case in all too many situations. And there are great companies out there who do create psychologically safe environments. We don't hear about them that much.
No, you don't.
That's the unfortunate thing.
Indeed.
And when we hear about them, they should get the promotion that's due to them. But a good example of being a good corporate citizen is very recent in Canada with the Syncrude and Fort McMurray, the devastating fire. And the big oil companies have, to a company, continued to pay employee salaries, advance incentive programs or bonuses, given loans, and provided other support relief. And I would suggest to you that the culture of those organizations is one where it is likely a very sound and stable culture that has dedicated themselves to earning the loyalty of their employees.
So there is reason to hope.
There is reason to hope, but as you pointed out a bit earlier, the short-termism does make it very difficult for organizations to do the right thing and still be competitive. And there are movements afoot to change the whole nature of going from period or quarterly reporting to reporting on a half-year basis. And that would relieve the pressure significantly relative to how businesses operate.
Interesting. Let's say I am working in an environment where the board really is filled with bullies who act out in their various ways, and it really has trickled down, that sort of worst case scenario that you described a little bit ago. And it's trickled to the, you know, from the board to the chief executives to everybody throughout the company. At what point, or is there a point where I call a lawyer, where I quit my job, or do I continually try to hang in there and fight this huge battle?
Well, I address it in my book, and I am calling on people who operate in that exact scenario to become activists. So, as you can have an activist board, you should have an activist employee group. I'm perplexed at why I am perplexed, and I'm not, as to why in this period where this kind of abuse and behavior has become an epidemic, that employees have not unionized. And in part, it's because we're finding, and the employees have found, that unions are part of the problem versus part of the solution in unionized environments, and they can't offer the kind of protection against this kind of behavior. So I recommend that people organize themselves and start a process where they hold the organization and its CEO and the board accountable for the toxicity of the culture that they have to operate in.
And there is, in fact, such a thing as a toxic work environment.
Yes.
You know, I wonder how much you would advocate for job seekers to, in their various interviews, ask what the company values as a company. Ask what their goals are and what their future plans are. I think you would begin to get a sense early on as to whether or not you thought this was something that you could tolerate.
Yes, and there are a number of questions that can be asked, including why is this an external hire? Why aren't you hiring from within?
Oh, okay.
Why did the person leave? What's the average tenure in the department? So there's a number of questions that will provide, and again, I list all of these things in the book, on questions to ask of a prospective employer.
And clearly you're advocating that these questions be asked. I mean, I know
a lot
of times, particularly if you've been out of work for a long time, for example, the only question that you really feel like you can ask is, when can I start and how much are you going to pay me?
Yes. But there are still a number of people who go from one situation to another. Unless you're totally desperate just to get the job, it's very, very prudent to ask those questions.
And, you know, maybe if you are desperate to get the job, it's okay to ask those questions so that if you tell yourself you've got to take this job, you're very clear that it's short term while you keep looking.
Yes. Yes.
When you think about the world of work as it stands today, if I were to give you a magic wand, tell you that it worked, what's the ideal work environment for you?
Well, the ideal work environment is simply a safe environment. And it's an environment where I am very comfortable in expressing how I feel, good and bad. It's an environment where my contribution has a purpose and is recognized. And it's an environment where people generally work very well together for that common purpose.
So a psychologically safe environment.
Psychologically safe work environment. And, you know, again, it's very simple. It's what are the stress factors, unnecessary stress factors in an organization? And the only way you can find that out is by asking people, how do you feel about your work? Why do you feel the way you do? To what extent do you think you're working to your full potential? And it identifies the unnecessary stress factors out there. It identifies what motivates people. It identifies what people believe they can and how, to what extent that they can contribute. Not just on productivity, but things like innovation and creativity. Things like speaking well of the organization and encouraging customers to come back.
One of the points that you make, and I'm going to have to ask you to give me a brief response because we're just about out of time, but one of the points that you make is that one of the areas in which bullying can be a problem is those companies in which there is a lot of interaction with the public and not a lot of care for how the public feels or how the public is doing.
Yes. And so my brief answer to that is a recent story. It was in yesterday's either Wall Street Journal or New York Times, and it was on Domino's Pizza, where they have a systemic method to extort money and wages from people at the lowest rung on the ladder in terms of substandard pay, as or sub-minimum pay, I should say, as it is, and it's just a horrific story. And what that tells me is the Domino's, if what the expose is correct, Domino's feel the same about their vendors, their stakeholders, and most importantly, their customers. And so if they're extorting wages from their employees, there are other things going on in that organization that needs to be addressed.
Thank you very much, Andrew Foss, the author of The Bully's Trap, Bullying in the Workplace, a management advisor, a former senior executive with two of Canada's largest retail organizations, and now the head of the Foss Foundation, a foundation that focuses on healthcare, education, and medical research. Thank you again, Andrew, so much for joining us today for this very important conversation.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
Alrighty. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily on demand and is available as a public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with the professional of your choice. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, an email to Pamela@mindtalk.org is the thing to do. That's Pamela@mindtalk.org. And remember, always, if it's unacceptable, then that's kind of what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.